All right. Well, welcome to the Chest Wall Injury Society Ribcast today. We are very excited to have Dr. Darwin Ang joining us today to discuss his rib fracture plating trial, which is sponsored by Synthes. First off, joining me as my co-moderator today is Dr. Tom White. Tom, welcome.
Good afternoon.
And, of course, our guest of honor is Dr. Ang. So, Darwin, why don't you start off by saying, tell us a little bit who you are, where you're from, what got you interested in rib plating, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, my name is Darwin. I'm a trauma surgeon and surgical intensivist. I think I've been doing rib plating for a while, at least, I want to say, probably since maybe 2008 or so, and really at some point in time I took interest in the outcomes of patients after doing some outcomes research on complications in trauma centers, and I realized a lot of the patients had pulmonary compromise, and a substantial amount of trauma patients, like 10% of patients, had rib fracture. So that's kind of where it all started. I'm currently at Ocala, Florida, part of the HCA Trauma Network. I serve as a medical director for a level 2 trauma center. And I have a keen interest in outcomes research from a surgical standpoint. I like trauma, emergency general surgery, and critical care.
Okay, great. Well, why don't we dive right in? Darwin, why don't you tell us about the trial that you're running and maybe explain the background behind it and how you got it started.
Sure. I think in 2013 or 2014, Synthes put out a request for proposal for research projects around fractured ribs and fixation, and we applied to that grant. And fortunately for us, we were approved, and our research looks at rib stabilization for clinically significant rib fractures. And so what we're interested in looking at are patients that have some significant compromise that could, in theory, cause pulmonary compromise in these trauma patients. So we have a fairly defined set of patients that we think have clinically significant rib fractures, namely if they have, you know, worsening pulmonary function, venatory compromise, significant pain. With rib fractures, these types of patients will be included in our study. So it's a pretty broad category of rib fracture patients. It's kind of, before our study, people are looking specifically at flailed ribs, but that's not very common. And while fractured ribs are very common, we thought we'd look at that and sort of use what we thought were clinically significant rib fractures and see if stabilizing these rib fractures would improve our outcomes. So the primary outcome of our study is looking at ICU length of stay. We have a lot of other secondary outcomes that we're looking at, including ventilatory days, amount of narcotics being used, their functional status, long-term pain issues, complication rates, and mortality. But the primary outcome of this study is ICU length of stay.
Darwin, you mentioned clinical significance. How are you determining that?
So that it goes with our inclusion criteria. And so, you know, this is a specific group of patients between the ages of 18 and 90. And so they have to have 3 or more rib fractures with worsening pulmonary function. In other words, they need oxygen support to keep their SATs up. They have worsening ventilation, like a high respiratory rate greater than 25, or they have a flail chest. So it would be consistent with the traditional studies, greater than 3 consecutive ribs. Or the other thing that makes the project unique is significant pain and disability. So we use something called a functional pain scale, or an FPS. They have to have a rating of 3 or greater. And basically, the patients have to say that the pain is intolerable. So if they use that word, it's intolerable, that gets them as a clinically significant pain. Clinically significant rib fractures. And then we also have some other classic definitions, like if they have rib fractures that are three or more with greater than one rib cortical diameter. So that's a radiographic finding. They would be included. And then the last thing that I think we have is a deformity and defect. So if they have a significant intrapleural deformity, and there's no rib limit on that. So those are collectively what we consider as clinically significant rib fractures.
I understand that your surgeons, you've gone to great lengths to sort of standardize the surgical technique. Can you tell us how you've done that and how successful that's been?
So, as in any surgery, techniques evolve over time, but we wanted to sort of standardize ours to the classic posterior lateral thoracotomy. So, we're not doing any of the intrapleural fixation or stabilization. So that's the first one. If some people are comfortable with some of the percutaneous methodology and things, that's acceptable as well. But for people that are new, that are just learning to use this, we use a standard open posterior lateral thoracotomy and not necessarily a muscle sparing.
And how many centers are involved?
So we have about 9 centers that are involved. Most of them are in Florida. We have one in South Carolina and another one in Kansas.
And have they all all the surgeons have been to a training session, or have they been proctored in some way? How are you guaranteeing their bona fides, basically?
Yeah, so when we first started the trial, we actually all met off-site together. And I would say about 60 to 70% of the surgeons that participated had some experience already in rib plating. But we actually had a cadaver lab before the start of the study. And we all kind of went through the different surgical techniques and plated cadaver ribs. And then once they got that initial course, their first rib plating on an actual patient, they were actually proctored by people who have done rib plating already before. And we kind of, left it up to the surgeon when they felt comfortable flying solo. But, most of the surgeons did several with their partners before they decided to do it on their own.
And, Darwin, is there some stipulation that, oftentimes these fractures are in locations that are difficult to access, either too high or maybe too far posterior. How are you controlling for those types of factors as well? Maybe the fractures that are not plateable with the current technology.
Right. So that's a good question. We typically don't plate the first and second ribs, and then we discourage people trying to plate any ribs that are less than 3 centimeters from the vertebral column. So, the qualifier in the inclusion criteria, they have to be plateable. So they can't be too high, and they can't be too close to the vertebral column.
Can you tell us about the specifics of the randomization or the window of opportunity here, basically? How quickly do they have to be randomized, and how quickly are they being done?
So we want to be able to plate them within 5 days of their injury. And so we try to get the consent at least within the first 48 hours. So the study is relatively soon after injuries is when they get randomized and operated on. So they have to have surgery within 5 days.
Darwin, do you have a standardized pain control algorithm that you're following with these folks as well?
Yeah, we do. We have a standardized pain algorithm, which is also the medical arm as well. They use, the same pain algorithm. So the first thing they get is a PCA and a pain-adjusted narcotic dosing, and then we provide NSAIDs. If the pain doesn't get better, then they go to either getting paravertebrals or epidurals. we have standardized order sets, and because all of us are within the HCA umbrella, our electronic order sets are pretty standardized. We use the exact same order sets, you know, from center to center.
And so everybody gets an epidural or a paravertebral before going to rib plating, or is just
No, not at all. Like, some people have their pain controlled. They don't even get to that point. And it's mainly the medical arm that ends up getting the paravertebral or epidural. We've had one patient that had dilated colon syndrome from narcotics, and we had to move to an epidural to get them over that. Yeah, most of the patients in the operative arm, we found that don't need to get to the paravertebral epidural part, because we're plating them relatively soon, right? Like within 5 days of the injury.
So, Dara, it sounds like it's a very well-designed study, and your patient group is real world, and sounds like the results will be fairly generalizable. I commend you on your effort. But I think what everybody wants to know at this point, or what I want to know, is how has randomization been? How challenging has it been? And mm-hmm. Do you have any things you wish you had done differently when designing and initiating the protocol?
Well, you know, the study was originally supposed to last only 3.5 years, and we're right at our 3.5 year mark. We've randomized 119 patients, but the total number, we're about halfway there now. We're actually just over the halfway point, where we're going to randomize 236 patients. So it's taken a while to kind of get these patients into the study, but, you know, in retrospect, looking at a lot of the challenges that we face, there's two groups, I think. One group is the patient side. It's really hard to randomize patients to surgery because it's not like taking a pill, right? Like, you take a pill and, you know, not think twice about it. And, you know, the effects are like, if you don't like it, you don't have to take the next pill. The patient's, you know, psyche is built that way. But surgery is sort of permanent. It's not like you can stop, once you get to surgery, that's pretty much it. And I think when approaching people about, you know, do you want surgery or not surgery, that's a pretty loaded question. I think a lot of things go through their mind. Do we want to be cut on? Do they want to go under general anesthesia if they can avoid it and stuff? And then you also have the other side of it, where some people just want to have the problem fixed. So they don't even want to have the possibility of not having surgery.
Right.
And part of the challenge, too, is that, you know, sometimes you have staff that are well-meaning or ED physicians. They'll advertise your centers, oh, you know, these guys, they do great rib plating, and we see patients all tend to do great from this rib plating. We've even had patients that were referred to us. We have about 1,000 referrals a year for trauma, and we have several people being referred to us for really bad rib fractures, and those ED docs at those other institutions, you know, they sort of brag about our rib plating. Oh, these guys do great rib plating. And when the patients come, they're like, well, we want the rib plating, and they automatically are selected out of study. The other part of...
Can I ask you which of those two scenarios is more common? The one that, the first one where patients don't want to be randomized to the possibility of an operation, or those who don't want to take a 50-50 chance that they won't get an operation that they think they need? Which
most
of those do you think is more common?
Most people don't want to be cut on, I think. And that's not surprising. They, you know, people, surgery to a lot of people is a black box. And, you know, we can't, because of the data, the existing data, we can't tell them for sure whether or not they're going to do better or not, which adds another level of doubt in their mind. So, by far, most people that don't want to participate in the study don't want to be cut on. The other aspect is the physician aspect. So the challenge is, if you have a bunch of people that do a lot of rib plating, or I like to call them pro platers, you know, they think they want to plate everybody and stuff. So getting equipoise is very, very difficult. So, for example,
That issue has come up for us in our discussions for about designing research projects. Is how do you know where do we get to the point where equipoise is? So I imagine that must be a very tough thing.
It was extremely challenging for us. And you're right. We got to a point where we actually had to change our practice pattern, and you know, objectively so. We pulled out all the data. There was really no level one data suggesting that rib plating was going to benefit patients. So we started from there. And once we all agreed that, you know, the existing data needed to be improved, and we had an opportunity to improve that, and my partner saw the bigger picture, it was easier to get equipoise. And initially, it wasn't perfect. Obviously, you know, you have some people who say, well, if we don't plate this person, they're going to die, and I'm not going to let that happen, you know. But, you know, we've all seen and been part of practices where we've had patients with horrific swell chests and, you know, they leave the hospital. Now, what is their functional status afterwards? You know, that's what also we're studying with the SF36 and the PEAK-6. But, you know, again, you know, non-plating these significant rib fractures have been pretty much standard of care. So we changed our practice where we basically only plated patients, you know, that fell outside of the inclusion criteria. But for the most part, we only plated patients that actually randomized into the operative arm. And again, we did that using evidence-based practices and reviewing the literature among our partners and getting everybody on the same page. So that was one. So I'd say that. I mean, the other thing that is sometimes can be challenging that we sort of learn later on is non-native English speakers. So Florida has a large Spanish-speaking population. And so making sure that patients that didn't speak a lot of English could understand the process of randomization and consenting and had an informed consent that was approved by our IRB for Spanish speakers only, and getting that through, that was one of the things that we learned and did sort of late, but it did help us pick up more patients. So I think, you know, the patients that we do have are solid patients. They definitely meet our inclusion criteria. And, you know, the other thing that I wanted to point out is as you go forth with a study like this, it's always difficult the first few patients that you're trying to consent. But after you get several under your belt, the consenting process gets easier, and for whatever reason, it then becomes easier to recruit patients into the study.
Easier on the part of the surgeon who's delivering the message. It's just you get more skilled.
The surgeon doesn't consent patient for surgery because we have to be nonpartisan, and we can't really bias the study by being part of the consenting process. And so the way we do it is that we identify patients as surgeons that meet the inclusion criteria, and we bring that to the study coordinator's attention. A study coordinator has nothing to do with the clinical care of the patient, but they basically go to the patient. They obviously introduce who they are. They explain the study and explain the background of the study and what we're trying to do, and they're the ones that do the consenting. Now, if the patients have any specific questions about the surgery, they try to answer as much as they can. But if it's something technical that they can't answer, then the surgeon, you know, will answer that for them and whatnot. But we, as surgeons, stay out of the consenting process and the influence, you know, as much as we can. In fact, we kind of take it like Fight Club. We joke about it. We don't talk about rib plating. And so, you know, we have a residency program now, and one of the challenges, too, is another challenge is getting the residents not to talk about rib plating because they want to do surgery. So I think that's another thing. If you have a residency program and, you know, residents are eager to do surgery and they want to do these things, they also have to be involved, not just surgeons.
It seems antithetical or heretical to not involve the surgeon in a decision that's as complex as that, that requires judgment and experience and a thorough knowledge of the benefits and disadvantages of an operation like that. So I'm wondering if that's hampering your enrollment rate, or maybe your opinion is that it's actually helping your enrollment. So can you comment on that?
That's a good question. So you're right on both ends, right? Like, you'll have a group of surgeons that will look at a patient and they'll feel very strongly, if they haven't bought into equipoise, that this patient needs surgery and they don't meet inclusion criteria of the study, when they actually do. Then you have the other group of surgeons that need an infrastructure at which what kind of patients will meet the inclusion criteria, which is why we have very defined, we actually have a checkbox that we give. We have the inclusion-exclusion criteria checkbox that everybody has. We laminate it so that they can look at it and see whether or not their patient meets those criteria. And the surgeon isn't out of the loop in terms of patient selection. In fact, it's the opposite. They're the ones that identify the patients for the study. The study coordinator is the one that then, based on, you know, the surgeon referral, goes to the patient. We also have a process where our study coordinators go, and they're supposed to go look at their patient census and screen patients. So if they see a patient that potentially could be part of the trial, they would approach the surgeon and say, what about Mrs. Smith? She's got several refractures. Would she or would she not? The other thing that I think people take for granted in our study, because it's an exclusion criteria, is the amount of chronic opioid use. So that's an exclusion criteria. And you guys know that in the United States, opioid abuse is just rampant. It's an epidemic now. And so we're actually seeing a lot of that among our trauma patients that come in. They're on chronic opioids and whatnot. And because one of our outcomes, our secondary outcomes, is the unit, you know, morphine equivalent units of narcotics,
yeah,
that people really need after plating versus no plating, right? That would basically confound our results. So that, you know, it's not the lack of rib fracture. So when we did our sample size calculation, you know, we had tons of patients with rib fractures within our trauma network. The thing that we didn't account for was the amount of patients also that were excluded secondary to chronic narcotic use.
Oh, my.
So that kind of slowed things down as well.
Let me ask you a question about that, the rate of enrollment. Has it accelerated since you initiated the study, or is it slowing down, or has
it
been pretty steady?
It's slowed down. It's been – actually, it's grown – it's a linear growth. It's definitely not exponential. The slope isn't that steep, but it has grown.
So you're fairly confident you're going to get to your number of 236 in the next couple of years?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, it's actually, yeah, we're definitely, we're recruiting more this year than we did at the same time last year. So
I was curious, Darwin, about the, do you have any idea about the crossover rate? Do you know how many patients or what percentage of patients who initially are randomized to the medical arm decide after a couple of days that they want an operation instead? Is that a frequent phenomenon? Or,
you know, it happens the other direction too. Like people that they consent for surgery and at last minute they change their mind. I want to say between 5% and 10% is the crossover rate. So we'll do basically intention to treat analysis. So whatever arm they fall in, we're going to treat that. But then there's also per protocol analysis, right? That's actually if they got plated and they, regardless of what arm they're in, and if they didn't get plated, regardless, you know, what arm they're in, they compare those two results. So when we publish our results, we're going to have per protocol analysis outcome and likely per protocol analysis, and definitely the intention to treat analysis.
Very good. And remind me, this is Synthes sponsored and underwritten, and they only the matrix rib system is being used in this trial, correct?
Yeah, that's not a restriction on the grant. There's actually no language saying that we have to use the Synthes rib matrix technology. We do, just because, you know, I wanted to standardize materials. And I didn't want it to be really about the commercialization of rib product versus another rib product. But yes, this is sponsored by Synthes and underwritten by them, but they do not require us just to use their products.
Is anyone using the splints?
No one is using the splints. We're strictly using plates.
Strictly plates, okay. And you haven't had any reason to stop the study early? You haven't had any significant...
We have a data safety monitoring board, a DSMB, and we're at the halfway point. And so this is a separate group, as you know. They have a statistician, trauma surgeons, surgical intensivists, people that do rib plating, take care of these patients. They're going to get together. We're giving them our data, and they're going to do an interim analysis. And one of three things is going to happen. One, you know, they say it's dangerous and we got to stop the trial. Two, the outcomes are still underpowered because, you know, we don't have a positive outcome yet. And this study is in its current state is underpowered. So we're told to continue until we get our true sample size. Or three, which would be like, you know, the Hail Mary, like, oh, wow, you know, rib plating is overwhelmingly positive, really good. And then we can stop the study now and write this up.
Yeah, unethical.
So that's kind of where that's at. So we don't know what our outcomes are, despite the fact that we have 119 patients in our registry, because we don't want to confound our eventual analysis by doing our own interim analysis. So we're letting the DSMB do that for us.
Sure. Norman, what do you think, after doing this trial for a while now, what do you think are the next easy or sort of the next steps for researchers in general, maybe through a network or something like that? What questions are ripe for the picking, so to speak, in your mind?
Well, you know, I think choosing different outcome points. You know, we chose ICU length of stay because we were kind of powered to be able to do that. But once through this study, we kind of see the actual prevalence of certain things, and that is going to eventually adjust the sample size needed to answer some key questions. Narcotic usage. The other one that I think is a low-hanging fruit is, you know, you may not see as much inpatient outcome changes, or you may, we don't know. But one thing that I think that a lot of people are interested in are functional outcomes after discharge. When are they going back to work? How many patients are you preventing from going to a rehab center and actually letting them go back home? So lots of parties would be interested in that question, right? Like, for example, insurance companies, if you can show that you prevented X percentage of people from needing, you know, secondary care at a rehab or a SNF, and by rib plating them, they'll go home. Maybe rib plating will be reimbursed by these insurance companies because I know that they'll save money and patient outcomes will improve from that. So, you know, I'm thinking, you know, one of the big thrusts in the rib plating realm will be, you know, outpatient outcomes and, you know, how patients do. The other one is, you know, as we move forward, as our surgical technique gets refined, the materials that we use, I think there's a lot of room for optimizing the actual materials that we're using, you know. having like self-locking screws, thinner plates, maybe plates that are absorbable, and looking at different technologies to be able to take care of these patients, improve the efficiency and speed of the surgery, and then also limit the amount of potential morbidity, from infection or chronic pain from the actual hardware itself, and things like that.
Well, at this point, I'm going to put in a shameless plug for the CWIS's annual meeting, March 2 through 4, Park City, Utah. Darwin, will we see you there?
Absolutely.
On the spot.
Big fan of it. Yeah, I'm really committed to it.
Well, it'd be great for you to be able to update us. Maybe you'll have some of the results from your interim analysis that you can share and sort of re-energize people about this study. I think, as far as I know, it's the only randomized prospective trial that's underway currently on involving rib fracture patients. So again, I congratulate you on your hard work and your foresight. I think when it's published, it'll be a very important piece of information for those of us who are passionate about chest wall injury.
Yeah, well, I appreciate the opportunity to kind of share our study, and it's been an exciting process for us, and hopefully we'll see some positive results. But whatever the outcome is, we'll be a lot more educated about rib fractures, I feel, and rib plating.
Yes, indeed.
I don't think I have any more questions, Steve. Yeah, thanks, Darwin, for your time. Very much appreciated, and thanks for contributing to the overall body of knowledge as well.
Hey, it's my pleasure, and I look forward to catching up with you guys in Utah.
Yeah, okay. Sounds great.
Thanks, Darwin. Take care, man.
All right. Take care, guys.